Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. Today is January the 15th, 2020. A shout out to all the military men and women serving our country. We thank you for your services. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. Do you know who has your personal data? Do you know how Facebook, Google, Amazon, and the other big tech companies are using your personal data? Our website is pcradioshow.org. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, streaming on the Internet. Podcast of the program is available on prn.fm, on the Internet, and pcradioshow.org. To listen to the live program on the telephone each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, the number is 641-793-7091. You can leave us a message with your questions or comments at hank@radioshow.org. In the news, City of New York plans for open internet competition. Robots out of work in San Francisco. Everything old may be new again with the Samsung foldable phone. Homeland Security issues critical security warning on Firefox 72. And Congress asking the FCC to protect consumers from SIM swapping. The feature segments tonight are HyperX Alpha Gaming Headset Review, Importance of Quality Assurance, Cyber Crooks Are Targeting Retirement Accounts, and Infighting with the Internet of Things will end soon. New York has a plan to fix broadband by introducing actual competition. The massive new network would be open access, forcing multiple new ISPs to compete for your broadband dollar. The city is plagued by a lack of competition in the broadband sector, leaving city residents with a choice of just one or two giant internet service providers, eager to overcharge consumers for what's usually substandard service. A new major city proposal hopes to finally change all that. This week, the mayor's office of the chief technology officer released what it's calling its Internet Master Plan, a massive new proposal to create a citywide open access broadband network, bringing faster, cheaper service to anybody that wants it. The city won't be building its own broadband network alone, something hundreds of U.S. communities have explored due to frustration with the status quo. Instead, the city hopes to strike a new partnership with private companies to help build a new fiber and wireless network serving all 8.5 million New Yorkers across all five boroughs. The private market has failed to deliver the internet in a way that works for all New Yorkers. The plan notes pointing out that 29% of New York City households don't have broadband, and 46% of families living below the poverty line don't have service, usually because of high prices. 18% of residents, that's more than 1.5 million New Yorkers, have neither a mobile connection nor a home broadband connection. The significant portion of the city residents face barriers to education, employment, banking, healthcare, social networks, and government services in ways that other residents do not. The city's findings lean on notoriously stale and unreliable FCC data, meaning that the problem is likely worse than the city leaders realize. To fix it, the city says it will put out a call for private partners later this year for around $2.1 billion. Leaders say the project can deploy a fiber and wireless network that leans heavily on government-owned infrastructure. What's more, the network will be open access, leaving multiple ISPs invited to come in and compete over the same network. In 2009, the FCC funded a Harvard study that concluded the competition created by open access models results in lower broadband prices and better service. You can see the concept on display in Ammon, Idaho, where city leaders built an open access, community-owned broadband network that lets locals switch ISPs in a matter of seconds. New York City's proposal will begin by sending out a formal request for private sector assistance later this year. From there, the city promises to offer its private sector partners broad access to city infrastructure, including 800 city rooftops, and 20,000 poles to deploy both fiber and a neutral radio access network capable of reaching every corner of the city. City leaders are quick to insist that building a better alternative to the status quo could, and under ideal circumstances, create 165,000 new jobs, a $49 billion increase in personal income, and up to $142 billion in incremental gross city product by 2045. These economic impacts cannot be fully realized under the current conditions of the internet in the city. Like many past proposals, the success of the venture will depend on the city's willingness to follow through and stand up to the industry giants, something that historically hasn't been government's strong suit. In New York's case, however, the project is motivated by years of souring relationships with existing broadband providers. In 2008, Verizon struck a closed-door agreement with then-Mayor Michael Bloomberg to bring fiber to the entire city by 2014. But despite getting ample tax breaks under the plan, Verizon never completed its network build, resulting in an ongoing city lawsuit against the provider. Verizon's only major competitor in the city, Spectrum, was almost kicked out of New York State entirely for poor service, lying to regulators, and failing to meet conditions affixed to the company's $78.7 billion acquisition of Time Warner Cable in 2016. Combined, the two providers enjoy a monopoly over New York City broadband. The end result is the same as what you'll find across vast swaths of the United States: slow speeds, comically bad customer service, and a disdain for concepts like privacy and net neutrality. A former FCC lawyer told Motherboard that the city's proposal is the most thoughtful and comprehensive blueprint she's seen by a major city looking to fix the broadband problem. The federal government has failed to meet the broadband needs of tens of millions of Americans. It is therefore incumbent upon states, cities, and municipalities to step up where the federal government has stood down. The city is also promising that, unlike incumbent ISPs, the city's new network will respect concepts like privacy and net neutrality once completed. With the FCC now widely viewed as a rubber stamp for industry desires, the onus rests on localities to pick up the slack. Every New Yorker deserves easy, affordable access to the internet. New York Mayor Bill de Blasio said that every New Yorker deserves easy, affordable access to the internet. With the Internet Master Plan, we are giving notice to corporations that the days of creating a digital divide in our city are over. For now, it's all talk. We got to see some action. There was an AP news item that caught my eyes: robots out of work as automated businesses closed in Bay Area. It has been a bad week for robots in the San Francisco Bay Area. A Silicon Valley company that used robots to make its pizzas closed this week, and three coffee shops in downtown San Francisco that used robots as baristas also closed up. Zoom Pizza said it is cutting 172 jobs in the Mountain View and eliminating another 80 jobs at its facility in San Francisco. Zoom chief executive made the announcement in an email to employees last Wednesday, and it was reported in the San Jose Mercury News. The Mountain View startup, which first began delivering pizzas in 2016, said it intends to focus on its food packaging and delivery systems. Former employees will be able to apply for the 100 new positions that Zoom expects to have in its packaging business. In San Francisco, Cafe X closed three of its coffee shops in the financial district. The startup founder said the downtown cafes helped develop the newest machines being used at shops at San Francisco International Airport and Mineta San Jose International Airport. When Cafe X launched in 2017, its robotic baristas joined robots that made smoothies and hamburgers or mixed and dispensed salads and quinoa bowls. Cafe X will continue to have competition in the automated coffee market. Brigo Coffee House has a robotic barista that can make 100 drinks per hour at San Francisco's Airport Terminal 3. Robotics have boomed in warehouses to speed up productivity and bring down costs and increasingly have moved into industries like food service. In the Bay Area, the popularity of robots stems in part from the region's infatuation with technology, food, and automation. It's just interesting that robots are out of work now. Everything old may be new again. Back to the future. What the heck am I referring to? Samsung's removable battery smartphone is coming to the United States for under $500. As a general rule, we don't normally comment on products that are announced but not market available until at a later date. The exception in this case is a smartphone with a removable battery. Fancy that. It's a mid-range smartphone from Samsung. It's Samsung's new rugged smartphone with a removable battery called the Galaxy X Cover Pro. It was revealed on its Finnish website before it was taken down, and Samsung has now officially announced a phone and it will cost under $500 when it's available in the United States in the first half of 2020. Samsung says it's working with Verizon to bring the phone to market. For that price, you're getting a phone with a swappable battery that's rated a hefty 4,050 milliampere hour, and the phone even supports 15-watt fast charging, as well as with special docks that use pogo pins. The X-Cover Pro is intended to be used by workers out in the field so that a huge battery should theoretically let workers use their phones for a longer period and give them the option to swap in a fresh battery in a pinch. The phone also has two programmable buttons, which Samsung says can be programmed for applications like push-to-talk, and if you're a Microsoft Teams user, you can use that button with the new Microsoft Teams walkie-talkie feature. Samsung says the X-Cover Pro is also EMV Level 1 certified, meaning you might be able to run a business where customers pay you by tapping their near-field communication-equipped credit card phone or watch to your Galaxy handset. The phone has Samsung's point-of-sale software built in, and the company says Visa approved this phone for its tap-to-phone payments pilot program. And to help the phone better survive the elements, Samsung says it has an IP68 dust and water-resistant rating and can withstand drops of up to 1.5 meters and that it's military standard 810G certified, which means it should theoretically be able to withstand extreme altitudes, temperatures, humidity, and other difficult conditions. What's missing? No specifications on size and weight of unit. The U.S. government confirms critical security warning for Firefox users. The United States Department of Homeland Security's Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency has issued a notification that encourages users and administrators to update the Mozilla Firefox web browser. This, despite Firefox releasing a significant program update to version 72 only on January the 7th. So, what is this reason for this level of government agency interest and indeed the urgency in the language that was used? A critical zero-day vulnerability that can enable a bad actor to take control over users' computers. A critical zero-day vulnerability that is being actively exploited in the wild. The Mozilla Foundation that makes the Firefox web browser published a security advisory January the 8th. That's one day after the big patch that they sent out January the 7th. That advisory addressed a critical zero-day vulnerability in Firefox that has been exploited in targeted attacks in the wild. What exactly is a zero-day vulnerability? A zero-day is simply a security vulnerability that is not known to the product vendor or security researchers, but crucially is known to bad actors who can then exploit it without anything preventing them. There remains little public disclosure as to the precise nature of the vulnerability itself. Beyond that, which Mozilla advisory reveals, that is, what we do know then is that this is a type confusion vulnerability. A type confusion vulnerability occurs when a program accesses a resource using an incompatible type, which can then trigger logical errors because the resource does not have expected properties. This in turn can lead to out-of-bounds memory access, and that opens the door to remote code execution. What do you need to do now? The Mozilla Foundation advisory states that it is aware of targeted attacks in the wild abusing this flaw. The good news is that a second update within a day of the first had been made available to Firefox that patches the vulnerability. Homeland Security has encouraged users and administrators to review the Mozilla Security Advisory for Firefox 72.0.1 and Firefox ESR 68.4.1 and apply the necessary updates. This should be considered as a matter of some urgency given that this critical zero day is being exploited already. Windows users can check to see if Firefox is safe by hitting the hamburger menu to the top right of the browser and selecting About Firefox from the Help section. For Apple users, the option can be found in the top Firefox menu. If your browser is showing as being version 72.0.1, well, then you are safe from this zero-day exploit. Enterprise users should ensure that they have updated to version 68.4.1 of Firefox ESR. Presenting Mark Leoso with his Quick Bite segment, review of the HyperX Alpha Gaming Headset.
I'm Mark Leoso with a Quick Bite. HyperX has released a new Cloud Alpha headset that goes beyond gaming. The dual drivers deliver high-quality sound. One carries the bass, the other driver delivers middle and high-range sounds, creating an enhanced gaming experience. Music lovers enjoy clear, distinctive tracks. Physically, the over-ear headset has large cups enclosing most ears, comfortable for many hours of continuous wear. The headband, made of aluminum, is lightweight and durable. The braided cable has an inline audio control for headset and microphone levels. An adapter is included for separate headphones and mic jacks, or a single four-pole headset jack for PCs or notebooks. The HyperX Cloud Alpha headphones have a detachable noise-canceling microphone and distortion control. This is the HyperX Cloud Alpha with more or less optimal mic placement. There's a small windscreen around it. And now we'll go back to the studio microphone. The HyperX Cloud Alpha is compatible with PlayStation 4 and Xbox One with a 3.5mm port controller that's included. For more information, visit HyperXGaming.com. That's a Quick Bite. I'm Mark Leosa.
Thank you, Mark. Lawmakers are prodding the FCC to act on SIM swapping. Crooks have stolen tens of millions of dollars and other valuable commodities from thousands of consumers via SIM swapping, a particularly invasive form of fraud that involves tricking a target's mobile carrier into transferring someone's wireless service to the device they control. But the U.S. Federal Communications Commission, the FCC, the entity responsible for overseeing wireless industry practices, has so far remained silent on the matter. Now, a cadre of lawmakers are demanding to know what, if anything, the agency might be doing to track and combat SIM swapping. About a half dozen Democrats in the House and Senate sent a letter to the FCC chairman asking the agency to require the carriers to offer more protections for consumers against unauthorized SIM swaps. Consumers have no choice but to rely on phone companies to protect them against SIM swaps, and they need to be able to count on the FCC to hold mobile carriers accountable when they fail to secure their systems and thus harm consumers. SIM swapping is an insidious form of mobile phone fraud that is often used to steal large amounts of cryptocurrencies and other items of value from victims. All too frequently, the scam involves bribing or tricking employees of mobile phone stores into seizing control of the target's phone number and diverting all texts and phone calls to the attacker's mobile device. Once in control of the stolen phone number, the attacker can then reset the password for any online account that allows password resets and or two-factor verification requests via text messages or automated phone calls. That is to say, most online services, including many of the mobile carriers' websites. From there, the scammers can pivot in a variety of directions, including plundering the victim's financial accounts, hacking their identities on social media platforms, viewing the victim's email and call history, and abusing that access to harass and scam their friends and family. The lawmakers asked the FCC to divulge whether it tracks consumer complaints about fraudulent SIM swapping and number port outs, which involve moving the victim's phone number to another carrier. The legislatures demanded to know whether the commission offers any guidance for consumers or carriers on this important issue, and if the FCC has initiated any investigations or taken enforcement actions against carriers that fail to secure customer accounts. The letter also requires the FCC to respond as to whether there is anything in federal regulations that prevents mobile carriers from sharing with banks information about the most recent SIM swap date of a customer as a way to flag potentially suspicious login attempts, a method already used by financial institutions in other countries, including Australia, United Kingdom, and several nations in Africa. Some carriers, both in the United States and abroad, have adopted policies that better protect customers from SIM swaps, such as allowing customers to add optional security protections to the account that prevents SIM swaps unless the customer visits a store and shows ID. Unfortunately, implementation of these additional security measures by wireless carriers in the United States is still spotty, and consumers are not likely to find out about the availability of these obscure optional security features until it's too late. Legitimate SIM swaps are a common request for all carriers, and they usually happen when a customer has lost their mobile phones or when they need to upgrade to a newer model that requires a different size SIM card, the small removable smart chip that ties the customer's device to their phone number. But unauthorized SIM swaps enable even low-skilled thieves to quickly turn a victim's life upside down and wrest control over a great deal of their online identities and finances. What's more, the security options available to wireless customers concerned about SIM swapping, such as personal identification number, which is the PIN number, or the PIN code, are largely ineffective against crooked or clueless mobile phone store employees. A successful SIM swap may allow tormentors to access a victim's email e-box even after the target has changed his or her password. For example, some email services allow customers to reset their passwords just by providing a piece of information that would likely only be known to legitimate account holders, such as the month and year the account was created, or the name of a custom folder or label in the account previously created by the user. One technique used by SIM swappers to regain access to hacked inboxes is to jot down this information once a SIM swap affords them the ability to reset the account password. Alternatively, SIM swappers have been known to create their own folders or labels in the hacked account to facilitate backdoor access later on. A number of young men have recently been criminally charged with using SIM swapping to steal accounts and cyber currencies like Bitcoin from victims. But experts say that few arrests that have been made in conjunction with SIM swapping attacks have pushed many involved in this crime to enlist help from co-conspirators who are minors and thus largely outside the reach of federal prosecutors. The FCC has so far seemed to have abdicated its responsibility over the carriers on this matter. It took them a long time to get around to taking robocalls seriously, but those scams really cost people millions of money. Imagine going into a bank and you don't remember your PIN and the teller says, "Oh, that's okay, I can look it up for you." The fact that a $9 an hour mobile store employee, well now a $15 an hour mobile store employee, can see your high security password or PIN is shocking. The carrier should also have to inform every single current and future customer that there is this high security option available. Presenting Benjamin Rockwell with his IT Pro Series, Importance of Quality Assurance. Presenting Benjamin Rockwell with his IT Pro Series, importance of quality assurance. Thank you, Benjamin.
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and now it's time to go to work. It's time for business. This is where I give you my past experience, my 30 years of experience, both current and past, of being an IT professional, of being a nerd for hire. And this is an area which is very important, and you may not have heard of this. I at least dropped this buzzword recently, quality assurance. Okay, it's sort of along the lines of, you've opened up your shirt, you've opened up whatever it is, you find this little tag and says it personally inspected by number 13, or Tom, or whoever it is, it doesn't matter who inspected it. That's something called quality control. Now, quality control is very similar to quality assurance. Quality control takes existing items that have a certain set of specifications, your shirt, for instance, and it makes sure that your shirt is of the proper size, that it doesn't have any loose threads, it doesn't have any problems with it. Now, quality assurance is something that happens before we even arrive at that quality control standpoint. Quality assurance says we're making this properly. It's designed to avoid any defects in advance, whereas quality control, that inspector, is identifying and fixing any defects that might have already happened. Now, frequently in a lot of IT areas, these are intertwined very heavily. We typically refer to these as QA. We refer to these as quality assurance. And this is an area where we go through and we have people that are assigned to test every single programming item that has been created. I think of Windows 10, for instance. Okay, so Windows 10, millions and millions of lines of code that are involved with making sure that your operating system is running properly. These different million lines of code have actually been programmed by one person. They've been double checked by somebody else, and that somebody else compares all of those different lines of code that were written by person one, and they say, okay, this should move on. Frequently, that second person isn't involved. It's something that Microsoft does do a lot of cross-checking. Are they perfect? Well, obviously not. But, you know, most major corporations are not perfect. The code that is involved with Windows, the operating system, or any operating system, the larger that code is in any different package, the more different items that have to be taken into consideration, and frequently, they are not. And that's unfortunate, but that's another story altogether. Quality assurance goes through and it makes sure that what was programmed actually works. It's somebody that sits there and they try to break the software. They try to go through and they try to say, hey, how can we break this? Now, frequently, they're given a long list of different checks to make sure that, okay, it's checking that I am going to press the letter G. I'm picking a letter at random, and the software is just looking for me pressing the letter G. What happens if I press H? Okay, what happens if I press I or J or K or L? They check those things. They also check to see that the resulting action is proper. So you press G, and when you press G, the program says, okay, you just told me to go. Does the program always go when we press G? Does it ever crash at this point? Does it have any issues from this point? Is this conflicting with some other portion in the software where I hit G and it doesn't say go? It says, oh, this is great. Like a double check to make sure everything's running properly. But no, it's not running properly because we want to tell it to go. You follow me there? It's this whole check through everything that we're doing. We can translate this into your car. That quality assurance happens during the design of the car. When we put the key into the ignition and we turn it to that second click, and then we turn it beyond that second click, that should start up the car. Now, yes, I know a lot of people these days now have the push button start. You just get in the car, you put your foot on the brake, you hit the button, and it just starts up like that. But in the old days, yeah, that first position was accessory. That second position was on, and that third position, that spring-loaded position, was, let's start the car, let's get going. So that quality assurance group would go through and say, here is the design. When we turn the key, it does the proper thing in each of those different positions, and it doesn't do anything surprising. It doesn't do anything kind of alarming, and they check everything. And this also applies again in IT. Now, does quality assurance pick up everything? No, we've already covered that. It's unfortunate, but that's how we wind up with a lot of these different bugs. We wind up with a lot of these different issues where, yeah, vulnerabilities happen within operating systems, within packages like Adobe Acrobat or Microsoft Word or Excel. They're all over the place. They abound. And yes, there are hackers out there that try to get in through those vulnerabilities. So quality assurance, while not perfect, is something that is required. It's something that we're going to have in any situation. From past experience, I've always had somebody check my programming. Whenever I did a report, I said, hey, is this the report you wanted? Look it over, compare the numbers, cross-check me. Make sure that I'm doing exactly what you want. And we should all be doing that. We should be doing that with our bosses in any regards. This is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. Cyber crooks are targeting retirement accounts. And, unlike credit cards, there's no guarantee you'll get your money back. A Milwaukee woman didn't check on the balance in her employer-sponsored retirement account very often. She said maybe every couple of months she would go online and take a look at it. When she logged in to view her account in November, she expected to see a balance of more than $80,000. Instead, she saw a balance of only $8,000. She was very shocked by that and thought there must be some mistake. She soon found out it was no mistake. Her money had been systemically withdrawn over the past couple of months. She learned after contacting her employee's retirement plan advisor and the mutual fund company that held the money. Someone had stolen her identity and was able to pose as her, changing her mailing address, redeeming big chunks of her mutual funds, and having checks mailed to new locations, first to the Minneapolis-St. Paul area and then New York City. A bank cashed the first two checks, but when she discovered the heist, payment was stopped on the third check. But another shock was still in store for her. When she contacted a representative at the mutual fund company, no immediate guarantee was made that she'll ever see that money again. Unlike with stolen credit cards, a saver's losses to fraud in retirement investment accounts aren't limited by federal law, although mutual fund companies typically say they'll reimburse funds lost to fraudulent activity. It's an issue to be aware of as cyber attacks on retirement funds rise. Hackers are finding it's getting harder to hack bank accounts, so they're saying, where else is there more money? Where can they go? And they started to discover 401k accounts. They started to discover retirement funds. Fraud in retirement accounts was rising, according to a report by the National Association of Plan Advisors. Cyber criminals today are looking for any possible route into people's financial transactions, and they're increasingly focusing their efforts outside financial institutions' firewalls. Email compromises, spear phishing, and social profiling are some of the key tactics being used to target all types of assets, including retirement accounts. In spear phishing, cyber bandits send emails, purportedly from a known or trusted sender, in the hope of persuading potential victims to reveal confidential financial information. The good news in the Milwaukee woman's case is that American Funds, the mutual fund company that holds her retirement savings, has agreed to restore the money she lost, even though at first she said representatives gave her no assurances of reimbursement. Still, what happened to her serves as a cautionary tale that people with 401k accounts and other types of retirement savings accounts need to be on guard. When crooks gain entry to consumer bank and retirement accounts, the point of entry more often than not is the victim's email account. Oftentimes, people account passwords obtained in data breaches and then sold on the dark web to cyber criminals are used to break into an email account and take it over without the victim knowing it. You've probably got a different password on your retirement account that you do on your email address. But what do you do if you forget that password? Well, you click Forgot Password, and they email a link to reset your password. So with access to your email address, they really have access to all those other things in a lot of cases. In the case of the Milwaukee woman, she doesn't know how a crook got into her American Funds account and started draining it. American Funds said the system wasn't hacked and that it sends out notices via postal mail when things like changes of address takes place online. People can't assume whomever holds their retirement money will reimburse them after a hack, but the biggest companies typically do. Charles Schwab, for example, states online it will cover 100% of any losses in any of their accounts due to unauthorized activity. Fidelity also says it will reimburse customers for any financial losses resulting from unauthorized activity on Fidelity accounts. American Funds states on its website, "We review each report of unauthorized access thoroughly, file appropriate notices with law enforcement agencies, and in the event of a financial loss, we reassess the facts and circumstances for potential reimbursement to your account." Companies do need to investigate the hacks for fraud and make sure law enforcement is notified when a crime has taken place. Cybersecurity experts say if retirement savers have access to their accounts online, one of the best things they can do is make it very hard for hackers to take over their accounts. And these are some of the tips that they recommend. Make sure any computer or device used to access account is protected by a firewall and has current antivirus and anti-spyware software. Be wary of responding to, opening attachments in, or clicking on links in emails that ask for your financial information. Open and read any letters or paper statements from your mutual fund or money manager to see if everything looks accurate and notify them promptly if it appears unauthorized activity has taken place. Investment firms often also will send letters via postal service to let clients know if any changes have been made to details like a home address. One important way of increasing security for an account is a strong password that isn't used for any other types of online accounts. Long passwords are better and easier to remember than shorter ones. Retirement accounts could be particularly vulnerable because account holders might neglect looking at their statements. In some cases, they've been told over the years just to let the money grow and not check on it too frequently. That advice isn't prudent anymore in age of cybercrime. This is why, with all financial transactions online, I do not recommend access via wireless communications. Presenting Marty Winston with his All Hands on Tech. Infighting with the Internet of Things will end soon.
By the end of 2020, home automation is going to be a very different category than what we have today. The changes are taking place both on the category's high ground and down in the trenches. You may have heard about some of this. Very few people know the rest. But listen closely, and you'll be among the world's best informed before the end of the show. Let's go back to the beginnings of the current wave, and I'm going to approach this as storytelling. So the chronological order may not fully echo the actual history, but it should, I hope, be easier to understand. We'll start with some Z's. No, not those. I mean Zigbee and Z-Wave. You may have heard those terms. A lot of home automation products will flag one or the other on the box or the web listing. They have a lot in common. Each one is a way to convey data over low-power radio signals. Each one connects every sensor or other device to every other device that's within its radio range. Each of these devices, we'll call them nodes, can do a pass-it-on bucket brigade from any one connected point to any other connected point. So eventually, your path connecting the farthest nodes may take, well, it may go a route that reminds you of the ball falling in a Plinko game, or maybe a Plinko game where it drops on, well, drops into an upside-down Plinko game. So it starts at a point, it goes any direction and all, and comes back to a point. Keep that image in your head for a minute, and I hope it all starts making more sense. How long does it take for data to get from one node to another? That depends on what path it takes, on how many times the data gets relayed, on how strong the signal strength is between any pair of nodes, and how many times signals have to be sent again until the error correction handshakes are happy with it. That delay between the time an originating node sends its data and the end recipient node receives it and acknowledges it and confirms it, that's called latency. And that latency, that delay, can become very significant. I'll get into that shortly. All these hodgepodge connection schemes have, of course, their own name. They're called mesh networks. Z-Wave is a mesh network. Zigbee is a mesh network. Bluetooth Smart Mesh is another mesh network that's used in home automation. And there are others. They're all on different radio frequencies. Think of those as channels. Each one has its own signaling standards, and not one of them is willing to work directly with any others. So if you just go out and buy a lot of interesting home automation products, the odds are they won't simply work together. Interoperability has never been part of their DNA. If they're on Zigbee, Zigbee things will talk to each other. If they're on Z-Wave, Z-Wave things will talk to each other, but try getting Z-Wave and Zigbee to talk, and it's frustrating. I'm not even including things that connect over Wi-Fi or low-band DECT signaling, and that was from cordless phones, or other kinds of Bluetooth other than Bluetooth Smart Mesh, or any of the splinter standards. I should also mention that Wi-Fi needs more power than small batteries can provide, and may often need to reconnect, which eats time. It's fine for building into AC-powered light bulbs and outlets, but for things that run on batteries, well, they can come with frustrations. For years, the home automation category was tribal and separatist and segregated and knee-deep in bravado. A lot of, ours is better than yours, so why don't you just surrender and come over to our side? A lot of, watch your back when IoT goes industrial and we win all the big installations. There's a bit of non-trivial tech I need to interject here before we get back to the spitting contests. All that latency, those delays in getting data from one corner of a mesh to another, those delays put a ceiling on how much traffic you can ever put onto a mesh. You're stuck with a need to limit the total number of nodes or the amount of data that a single node can send or how frequently a node can send updates. When I was scratch designing the thousands of sensors for a cybernetic house, that array, well, there was no way that a mesh network could ever handle all their data. And the same is true for industrial IoT. In my design, what I decided to do was to distribute scores of Raspberry Pi computers to node positions and connect those over wired Ethernet to each other and a master control area, and also connect their sensors and actuators through wires, mostly using the GPIO connections. And that leads me to two fundamental things about Zigbee and Z-Wave and Bluetooth Smart Mesh. One is that they are designed to support nodes that can each run for 3 months to 5 years on a small battery. They are designed for products that stick on or screw onto walls or windows or wherever with no wiring to power them and no wiring for data connections. Even today, a lot of those products look like little white plastic blobs stuck hither and yon. They have proven much more likely to attract spousal ridicule than spousal approval. Do you have home automation stuff? Does your spouse ever make negative comments about them or perhaps command their exorcism? Well, the landscape changed. You know what did it? Amazon and Google. They came into the house and did some pretty interesting things on their own. People bought them much faster than they ever bought into home automation products. Pretty soon, the thing you would see on the box bragged about a home automation product's ability to work with brand A or brand G. You could talk to that little thing and maybe get it to lock doors or turn lights on or off. Suddenly, it was practical, not just a stunt. But brand A and brand G, while each grew to be a huge flagship, still weren't talking to each other. And that's at the core of the best news of late 2019. Amazon and Google and Apple announced an agreement to find ways to work together and to be more transparent to each other. Microsoft was not part of that announcement, but they told me privately that they hope to involve Cortana in that. And as for Samsung's Bixby, well, it would be fine with me if it just goes away. By the end of 2020, for the big guys at least, cooperation and unification and federation are a promise that I believe they'll keep. I should also mention one outside element that has been instrumental in getting some limited cooperation among the throng of nodes out there. It's a web presence called IFTTT. Sounds like a cha-cha, doesn't it? IFTTT. Well, it stands for If This, Then That. If This, Then That. If you've done any computer programming at all, these are basic elements of conditional processing. If the temperature sensor on the back porch says it's 95 degrees or hotter, then broadcast a message over your home's personal assistant saying that the porch is dangerously hot and to make sure people or pets can leave it. You could also turn on a warning light to select a red color and flash it. If This, Then That. IFTTT does that kind of decision making, but in a moment, we'll add a lot of finesse to that. Do you own any home automation devices? How do you command them? These days, the answer is almost always a smartphone app, but have you thought about how that happens? When those companies pay attention to security, it happens without a cloud connection, usually over Bluetooth or locally only over your home's Wi-Fi network. That means that somewhere among those products is a node that may not be a sensor and may not be an actuator and probably does embed a controller, but is very likely to call itself a hub. I'm not sure if hub is the best name for it, though it may be easier for people to feel comfortable having one, given how familiar USB hubs are. Really, it's more of a gateway that connects the controller for its cluster of nodes into Bluetooth or on-site Wi-Fi, if they're good about security, or more commonly, if they're not so good, to the cloud, which is a cheap shortcut to making updates happen. If you were able to comb through all the home automation products at the January 2020 CES, you might see that an increasing number of hubs are beginning to embrace multiple protocols, for example, Z-Wave, as well as Bluetooth or Wi-Fi. When I did my homework on CES, I followed up to challenge some of those companies and some of their claims. Remember, as a journalist, I'm a professional smart-aleck know-it-all. One of the companies floored me three times. It's a company from the Netherlands, Atom, spelled with just five letters, A-T-H-O-M. Probably pronounce it at home, but I don't know. Anyway, they have a hardware device called Homey, H-O-M-E-Y. And you can go to atom.com or to homey.app, homey.app. What you'll see is a small tabletop sphere that acts as a gateway for just about every home automation protocol out there. Zigbee, Z-Wave, Bluetooth, Wi-Fi, infrared, like for TV remote controls, and more. It has all those radios, all those interfaces built into it. Even better, it can ultimately connect to any other hardware that can connect to wired Ethernet or Wi-Fi, any IP-compatible hardware or IP-addressable hardware. A lot of home automation product companies or their users take it one step further. They're providing plugins for simple and friendly access in this categorical wall buster, this world unifying hardware. In the sense of all the tribal and separatist history of home automation, Homey represents hardware desegregation. But there's more. The same company is also curing what's been wrong with the software that controls interaction within home automation. If This, Then That isn't enough anymore. If you've ever written programs, even in BASIC, I think you can appreciate what they're adding. Not just if and then, but if and then and else, plus and, plus or, plus user-defined variables. If you're not a programmer, think of it this way. finesse, the ability to make nuanced decisions. And you don't have to be a programmer. There's a high-level version of their interface that lives in a smartphone app, but is very graphical and very simple to set up, simpler than some vending machines. If you are a programmer, well, they support several of the most popular programming environments, or you can pick up what you need to talk to their hardware through the more advanced languages like C++. There's nothing you can't program in with these guys. I think they're going to turn out to be one of the cornerstone companies of the growth generation of home automation. So, this year, all that home automation can talk to each other. By the end of the year, you'll see it. Your home assistants will talk to each other. It will get even easier to get things that your surveillance camera recognizes, or weather info, or some of the newer kitchen appliances. Get all that involved, all without needing the hardware or software equivalents of diplomats or translators. Next time, for every one of you who openly or secretly wished you could have a Star Trek tricorder, would you like to know how close we're getting to putting one in your pocket? I'll talk about the tech that can put tricorder sensing into your smartphone, but also about the people I sense will want to stand in the way of that coming true, at least nearly as soon as they could make it so.
Thank you, Marty. Public service announcements. Computer Club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut Tri-State Region. The computer clubs have random access sessions at each of these club meetings. If you have any questions or need for technical advice, the club members are more than happy to assist, and there's no such thing as a dumb question. All these computer club meetings are open, free to the public. The Brookdale Computer Users Group will have a presentation on current trends in personal technology, Thursday, January the 23rd. Meeting time starts at 6:45 p.m. They meet at the Middletown Library Lodge Meeting Room, located at 55 New Monmouth Road in Middletown, New Jersey. Westchester PC Users Group has a presentation on how to smartify your home. Thursday, February the 6th, 2020, meeting time starts at 7 p.m., and they meet at the Keller Williams New York Realty, located at 120 Bloomingdale Road, White Plains, New York. Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey will have their main meeting on Friday, February the 7th, 2020, and the meeting time is 8 p.m. Scotch Plains Rescue Squad is where they meet, located in, of course, Scotch Plains, New Jersey. New York Amateur Computer Club has their general meeting on Thursday, February the 13th. Meeting time is 7 p.m. start, and it's at NYU 32 Waverly Place, Silver Building, and check at the front desk for the room number. And of course, they're located at Manhattan, New York. Long Island Macintosh Users Group meets Friday, February the 14th, Valentine's Day. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and they meet at the Old Westbury campus of the New York Institute of Technology. And the meeting place is at the Harry J. Scherr Hall. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on prn.fm, from the Internet, and pcradioshow.org. If you have any questions for us, well, just send us an email addressed to hank@pcradioshow.org. There is no such thing as a stupid question. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do regular backups. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of the staff, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station next week.